From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. A leadership show uncovering super bosses, corporate bad behavior, and announcing a new podcast to be known as the Sidcast from the leading business school professor behind the super bosses concept tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Sidney Finkelstein is the Stephen Roth Professor of Management at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, where I also got my MBA. He's the director of the Tuck Center for Leadership, listed in the Thinkers 50, the most prestigious global ranking of leadership gurus. Been on our show for his Wall Street Journal bestseller, Why Smart Leaders Fail, and Sid's most recent book, for which he was also a guest, Super Bosses, How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent. Welcome from Hanover, Sid. How are you?
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be talking to you.
All right. Third time's a charm. He's on, and I got my 40th reunion coming up, so I'll probably see you this fall.
I hope so.
Okay, you're a leader in leadership. Refresh us on what the whole super boss concept is about.
Yeah, sure. So I set out to try to understand who some of the most effective leaders were really in the world across all sorts of different industries. And I discovered these people. I end up calling them super bosses, who in a nutshell, they're leaders that create other leaders. They're leaders that see the potential in other people often before they even see it themselves. They're really people that have a track record, and you could see this, a track record of generating and regenerating talent on a continuous basis. And so when you talk to CEOs and you ask them what's top of mind, it's always talent, finding talent, retaining talent, getting the best talent. These super boss leaders have figured out how to do it.
And you had three categories, I think, as I recall last, looking at my notes. Just briefly talk about what they are.
Yep. So there were three types. They're more around personality or style, mm-hmm. not so much on behavior and what they did. The first type is maybe the one most people will think of. I call them nurturers. These are people that that enjoy helping other people get better. They see value in that. They're a bit closer to some of the mentors that that many people have had, although I kind of call them super mentors in the sense that they do what mentors do, but they do it to a deeper degree. These are the nurturers. The second category are a bit more of the creative types, and you see them a bit more in creative industries. You see them in Silicon Valley. You see them in a few places. I call them iconoclasts. These are leaders that help other people get better by virtue of being and attracting these other people who want to be part of the milieu, if you will, of the of the leader, and in this case, I'll say of the creative leader. And the motivation here, by the way, Miles Davis is an example of one of these iconoclasts, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, jazz talent in history. And so, why would he care about helping other people get better? Well, he was all about getting better himself, and he knew he would do that by surrounding himself with great people. And he also knew that by creating an atmosphere, an environment where people come together to create something new, something special. In this case, the leadership of his band and a lot of albums and music, everyone ends up getting better, and you end up with a much stronger net result, if you will. The third category, they're the tough boss, the super tough boss. I call them glorious bastards. And, yeah, these are people that they don't actually care all that much about their team members. But what they do care about is winning, and they understand that to win, they absolutely need to surround themselves with stars and superstars, and whoever they have, they need to help and push them to keep getting better. So it's not always easy to work for, say, Larry Ellison, who's the kind of classic glorious bastard. But if you can, and you can handle it, what he'll do for you and the way he'll accelerate your career is tremendous. There was someone I talked to who said working for Larry is like you count the years in dog years. Every year working for Larry is like 7 years working for somebody else. I mean, it's that type of impact. So those are the three types that we found.
You know, Larry Ellison, though, because I've followed him too, and I always thought he was impossible to work for from everything you heard. But you had him, I think, 9 of his 11 senior executives you've had have all gone on to be chairman, CEO, or COO of other companies. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hallmark of what a super boss does. He helps people do things with their career that is just top of the market, and often things they didn't even anticipate they could do.
I want to ask you about a couple of guys. You can say where they fit in. I follow GE very closely, and somehow Jeffrey Immelt, who went to Dartmouth, actually, now that I think about it, appears to have almost destroyed the company. And do you have any insight into that and his leadership? He was there for 16 years.
Yeah, he was there a long time. He's a tremendous talent. There were a lot of things that happened at GE that were unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Some mergers, I think the big one with the French company,
yes,
Alstom, turned out to really be a difficult one. He also inherited a company that was at the very, very, very top of the world when Jack Welch, the legendary Jack Welch, retired.
Right.
And he started work, either it was September 11th or it was very close to September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of things like that were happening. And then one of the keys to GE's success for years was their gigantic financial business. They were as big as any bank. And it turned out that wasn't really the best business to be in, especially when you come closer to 2008 and the financial crisis. So there are a lot of, there's not an excuse for him, but there are a lot of extenuating circumstances that I think would have made that job very, very difficult or challenging for anyone. But with respect to this focus on talent, he was known as someone in fact, GE historically, Jack Welch as well, historically were known and was known as a place that produced great talent. I think I think there's no doubt they've taken a hit. Yeah, with respect to that reputation, because of everything that's happened, but they're a place that has really emphasized helping people get better, and often it was tough love. Certainly with Jack, it was. He may have been closer to the Glorious Bastard style.
Mm-hmm.
You got to deal with him, but if you could, he could help you get so much better.
I think what Immelt is going to be remembered for poorly, though, is managing capital, allocating capital. The deals were overpriced sometimes, sold at the wrong time. Alston, as you know, has become a disaster, so that's unfortunate. Let me ask you now we'll take an entertainment guy who looks to be a talent machine as well, Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, Lorne Michaels is one of the people I interviewed and profiled in Superbosses. And he's just a great example. Obviously, Saturday Night Live, the producer, the creator of the show, and a number of fantastic comedians and now movie stars, really, and TV stars that have come out of SNL is enormous. And he's always been very thoughtful about who he would try to attract to the show, and then how he would manage them. And one of the things that I learned about Lorne Michaels in the research is how he really honed a competitive instinct amongst his troop, if you will. Because if you think about SNL, to get on the show, if you're a performer or a cast member, to get airtime on the show, you're forming a skit. It's not a stand-up comedy type of thing. You're forming a skit with other people. So you need to know how to collaborate. You need to know how to work well with other people. That sounds fine. But it also turns out that because of the structure of the show, they have something like 2.5 hours of programming on Friday, and by Saturday they're down to an hour and a half. And how do you go from 2.5 to 1.5 hours in a short period of time? That's the definition of competition. That's a scarce resource everybody wants, and not everybody's going to get it. And so you got to have some sharp elbows. You got to raise your game when you need to raise your game. And he even talked about that with me as a purposeful technique or tactic that he uses in developing talent and in thinking about teams. He thinks that the best teams and the best talent need to be able to work with other people and be collaborative, which everybody says that, but he also says they need to know how to compete and compete with each other even, which not a lot of people say and not a lot of people are comfortable with. You can't go too far in either direction, and that's the kind of the yin and the yang, the balance. So, yeah, Lorne Michaels, it's just endless, from Jimmy Fallon to Tina,
yeah,
Faye, and oh my God, and it goes way back to Belushi and all these others.
Bill Murray,
oh my goodness, yeah.
Does he consciously view himself as developing talent that will spin out on his own?
He has come along that way over time.
Yeah,
because he's realized that the platform that SNL has is unrivaled in American entertainment now, and probably for a couple of decades. And there will be people that are going to leave. They're going to get opportunities. I mean, Jimmy Fallon's a great example. Jimmy Fallon was really one of the stars. Tina Fey, I could say the same story. They were going to go. There's no question. They were getting opportunities. And what Lorne Michaels was clever enough to do in both of those instances and others, you know, Seth Meyers would be in that category, Amy Poehler, is, okay, you're going to go, you're getting these opportunities, but rather than end my return on investment in all the work I put in with you and the opportunities I gave you, let's see if we can continue to work together. And he did it by helping Jimmy Fallon become the host of The Tonight Show. And by the way, one of the producers, executive producers of The Tonight Show, is now Lorne Michaels.
Uh-huh. The Overconfident Boss, next segment. And we're back with Professor Sid Finkelstein of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. I'm going to ask you a little presidential leadership next, but as a good lead into that, tell us about the Overconfident Boss. I know you've written about it recently.
Yeah, it's something I've seen for a long time where when you get to arrogance and overconfidence, a lot of people can say that's a bad thing. But then you start to think about it and say, well, what about confidence? And I don't know any successful executive who is not very confident. Certainly the super boss leaders were very, very confident. But even, you know, any executive that's successful, you got to have that confidence. You got to believe you can do it. So there's this line from confidence to overconfidence to arrogance where you got to find the sweet spot. And that's what I've been thinking about based on work with a lot of executives, and wrote this thing in the Wall Street Journal not that long ago about that balance and how to think about it and what questions you could ask yourself to kind of assess whether you're in the right place.
And does an overconfident boss lead to what generally?
So an overconfident boss is going to shut down other points of view. You're going to lose some great talent because they don't get they're not going to have a chance to have as big of an impact. Let's face it, you know, when you work with someone who has got this kind of cockiness about them, it's not always that much fun. And nobody is always right. We know that as well. So people that have this tremendous confidence think they can make all the decisions. They get closer, by the way, to some of the wise, smart executives, fail leaders that I profiled a long time ago as well.
So that's kind of a good lead-in, actually. We've got the first president from the business world directly, and the White House. And we'll look at this just from a management objective point, not ideological. And there appears to be a lot of chaos, a lot of turnover, some mendacity, not a lot of loyalty either direction, some narcissistic, perhaps. And allegedly it's been successful in the business world. Do you see that the Trump presidency, do you see a leadership issue here, or how would you evaluate it?
Well, at the risk of getting my share of hate mail, there's really there's an obvious problem that just about anyone. You know, if you look at some of the things that I wrote about on overconfidence, I think he falls into, his behavior indicates he falls into each one of these traps. For example, do I often feel like I'm the smartest person in the room? Well, he has said that he's the smartest person in the room. Do I originate most of my ideas? Well, yeah, because you think you know more than everybody else. How much time do I really spend listening to other people? Well, you know, that's not something he seems to pride himself on. And do I think of myself as indispensable to my business's success, in this case, presidency's success? And that, of course, is obvious. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of warning signs that are out here. They've been out for a long time, and you see a revolving door at the White House as one of the pretty clear indicators of, a lot of really talented people that have come in and left, and when they leave, they almost always leave diminished in some important ways, and it makes you wonder why people keep coming back to want to work on this team.
You know, there's always the model that says you need a good chief of staff to keep everything under control and to drive the train. Reagan had that. Trump really does not like to be controlled, and he seems to have sort of remodeled the 26th floor of the Trump Tower, where he just sort of spoke to the wheel. People could come in when they wanted, and he ran everything. Can he be successful with that, A, and B, can you make someone that's not comfortable being controlled ever, and should you make them, susceptible to a strong, you know, chief of staff type culture?
Yeah, look, this type of management style or leadership style, where you're sitting up there and people can come and go,
yeah,
it's a chaotic system or any organization. There's a basic principle of management, of leadership, that's been around literally for 100 years. It's called the span of control. Mm-hmm. And it's a boring word, but it's pretty important. It means how many people can any one manager effectively manage? And research will tell you that it's anywhere from 5 to 8 as a sweet spot. And once you get beyond that, you just can't possibly do a good as effective a job. I mean, it's something that's been around in the business world for decades. And so if you have this kind of hub and spoke model, mm-hmm. where you're the hub and there's infinite number of spokes, you could see how that can't possibly be a good idea. And what ends up happening is you get infighting across people that want to get that airtime, that mm-hmm. use the time with the boss to campaign literally for what they think, well, for what they want, as opposed to a smaller group of people sitting together, knowledgeable people sitting together and having a real debate, a real discussion, trying to come up with the best type of solution. Now, you also asked someone with that style, can they change? And the answer is no, if that style is based on decades of work and decades of work that has been perceived certainly by Trump and others as tremendously successful.
So if I extrapolate what you're saying, is it impossible for him to be successful?
Impossible to be successful, no, because there's so many random things that happen. But what he's done is he's created so many barriers and so many pitfalls around him that it just makes it much more difficult. I mean, where does success come from? You need to have unbelievably great people, and that's not been the case unless you look at Fox News as your feeder school for your top talent, which not too many people are going to say. And then you need clear strategic direction. It seems to change all the time. You need to be able to communicate that effectively. Well, you know, we live in the age of Twitter, and he's a master of Twitter, and that has kind of been an erratic thing. And I mean, there's some fundamentals, and they're not in place. Unfortunately, the odds are not in favor.
How about give us an insight? Have you found a lot of women super bosses? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So I was very concerned about that early on in my research because I was focusing in particular on some of the most successful, most famous people in different industries. And to do that, you needed to have a multi-decade track record. And as soon as you say that, you realize, well, there are not that many women in senior executive positions when you go back 30 and 40 years, so that they would be the leaders today. Having said that, I dug in a little bit more, and we found people like an Oprah Winfrey, who has redefined the media and entertainment business, has helped create gigantic talents and almost new people doing creating their own platforms. You know, Dr. Phil, for example, Dr. Oz. These people owe so much to an Oprah Winfrey, and then, you know, in Silicon Valley, Sheryl Sandlin has always had that reputation. I think Facebook and Sandberg is having a bit of a challenging time now, but there are many people I've spoken to or heard about, mostly women, but not only, that speak about Sandberg in the highest way as someone who's really helped them accelerate their own careers. So there are some. I think it's important also to recognize that within any company, there are going to be potentially many super boss leaders. I didn't look at the middle manager or the lower-level manager in my own research, but I can tell you from speaking about this all over the place, you do book signings, so many people have asked me to sign the book over to their boss, who is someone I never heard of in a company, you know, I barely knew existed.
This is Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the BizTalk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Go to biztalkradio.com, find the one closest to you, listen over the Internet, access our podcast. We'll look at some business scandals, controversies in segment 3. He's a professor of leadership at the Tuck School and the author of the book Super Bosses, How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent. And he's starting a podcast, Sidcast, which we'll talk about in the final segment.
But I want to go through some scandals and you know whether these, some of these cultures seem to have repeat ones. But right now, a big one on the docket is Elon Musk and Tesla. He's been censured by the SEC, I think now twice, and there's a lot of overpromising, and the stock is being shorted, et cetera. How would you evaluate what's going on at Tesla and Elon Musk leadership?
You know, Elon Musk is a one-in-a-generation talent.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that in a positive way more than a negative way. Look at what this guy has done coming out of nowhere, in a sense. I mean, he was one of the key people at PayPal, and that got him a lot of money. That was, by the way, Reid Hoffman and other kind of royalty of Silicon Valley. And he's creating a car company from scratch. I mean, what talk about audacity.
Yeah.
And talk about something important as an electric car and a self-driving car, not yet, but on the way there. So this is a guy who's shooting for the stars, doesn't believe there's anything he can't do, and so that cuts both ways. That's someone that's got the nerve to go out and try to do some of these things, but it's also someone who doesn't always know how to turn it off and start to kind of back down when things are not going quite as well. And it's a bit surprising some of the things that he's done, you know, that's gotten him in trouble with the SEC. These are not complicated things. There's certain things you just cannot say as a CEO. And, you know, smoking weed on a show is never a good idea. Anyways, even in the era of, marijuana being legalized around in many states, it doesn't represent you particularly well as a leader. So he's making a lot of, I don't want to call it a rookie mistake because it wouldn't be accurate. The guy is way beyond rookie level. He's close to Hall of Fame level. But he's making those mistakes, and it's a bit of a puzzle, but to me it goes back to personality. Maybe it takes a certain type of personality to believe you can create an automobile company from scratch and beat GM and Ford and BMW for that matter and Toyota. And to have that nerve to do that sometimes might mean the rules don't apply to me.
Let me ask you this, if you've seen this in this research, there's a guy, an investment research guy, that is shorting Tesla in a big way, and he says he thinks that Musk is exhibiting signs of too much stress and making bad decisions under stress. Have you found there to be a link to that?
Well, I don't know whether that's something going on with Musk at all, yes, stress. So stress is an interesting thing. You need stress to be a high performer,
right?
But too much stress and bad, really bad things happen. This, by the way, is analogous to a lot of things when it comes to leadership. You know, something that's good for you, like confidence that we were talking about, you got to be confident, is good for you. And sometimes or often people think, well, if it's good for you, then more is better, and even more than that is the best of all.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually not that way at all. A little bit of stress good, too much stress can kill you.
Wells Fargo. That seems to be a culture issue as well, and it doesn't seem to quite get fixed.
Yeah, it's almost like there's some inevitability to this, because during the financial crisis, Wells Fargo was maybe the only major bank that came out not looking disastrous. And so they became the kind of a bit of a darling. And then and all these things come out about, you know, incentive systems in place, to encourage bank managers and bank tellers to start selling all kinds of things, and the problems keep on and they haven't managed. They did not manage that well. There is a cultural thing. It's very funny about the banking industry after 2008, and the immediate disaster was stemmed, and there was a lot of effort into trying to figure out what went wrong here. Why did these banks go wrong? The culprit became culture. This is what the regulators were talking about. I had a lot of people come talk to me about this. It was culture. The culture in these banks is broken, and they started hiring McKinsey and everyone else to try to fix the culture. They're not talking about culture in these banks anymore as if it's magically fixed. Wells Fargo is the one that today we're seeing kind of above the horizon, where you can see these problems happen. But it wouldn't shock me to hear of these types of problems in other places as well.
Let me ask you this. Can you change culture?
You could change culture, but don't think it's going to happen by bringing in McKinsey to do a report for you. It's going to take years and years to try to do it. Much easier is start off with a culture of that's going to pay some dividends for you, and then tinker with it as you need to.
Let me ask you about one. This happens to be near us in Greenwich, on the opioid crisis in Purdue Pharma. You know, they got a lot of criticism for, you know, fomenting addiction in America, and including marketing to doctors to try to get opioids prescribed for as minimal of pain as they could get away with. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, pharma is in the business of inventing wonderful things that then they need to sell as much as possible. And some of these things have gigantic downsides, and the opioids are one of them. There are many factors in the opioid epidemic, and certainly one of them is people that feel the need to keep doing this and can't manage to get off of them. But there are doctors and there are companies that's their business model: sell as much of this as you can, and so you have really an ethical. It's not just an ethical crisis; mm-hmm. It's almost a systemic crisis, because this is a for-profit company that has a responsibility to maximize shareholder value, mm-hmm. and that's what they did. And it turns out that it created gigantic negative externalities, as my economist friends say. It led to a lot of bad things happening. And so, what's the solution to that? They did what they were supposed to do in selling as much of this as they can. Mm-hmm. But there's got to be a moral side to business, and the systemic thing to me comes in because if the only purpose of a company is to maximize shareholder value, you're going to have these types. We have seen many of these types of problems. If the purpose of a company is to do everything you possibly can for shareholders, but also recognize that there are other stakeholders, if you will, that you have to balance their interests. Which is a movement that in Europe is certainly much stronger, and even in the U.S. is picking up. We have B Corps as a good example of that. Then I think we have a better opportunity to manage these types of things.
That leads me to a question. Business schools have been castigated to some degree about moving this focus to shareholder value maximization only. Is that a fair charge?
It is a fair charge. I would say if you were to survey my colleagues, at Tuck or any other top school, the vast majority of faculty members will say yes. The purpose of a for-profit corporation is to maximize shareholder value. I would not say it, and I get a lot of criticism for that. And some of my colleagues might not say that as well. It's not to say that you don't want to make a lot of money. I'm a capitalist as well. I think that's a great thing. But you got to recognize that there's more, that there are multiple stakeholders. And, you know, today there are more and more CEOs that are starting to see it. CEOs speaking out about, this is more in Silicon Valley than anywhere else, but speaking out about social issues. Part of it is because it's indirectly related to shareholder value. You know, in Silicon Valley, if you're a CEO who doesn't speak out in favor of, you know, gay marriage or equal rights of some form, you're going to have a lot of employees that are not going to want to be there. And so you have almost no choice to do it. So, yeah, the business schools have played a role, and not necessarily a positive role here.
Look at some industries now. Let's go to Wall Street for a second, and I'll hone in on Goldman Sachs. This $6 billion Malaysian sovereign wealth fund scandal, which we've covered, and Goldman facilitated the floating of the bonds. But they took a $600 million fee, right? And which is obviously, a huge proportion on a bond issuance. What do you think? And then now they're ensnared, I think, in a scandal that's going to cost them way more than the $600 million they made in the short term.
Yeah, well, they took everything they can. And for-profit companies that try to maximize shareholder value, you have a deal, and you have a customer, a client, that is willing to make that deal for you. Maybe they needed the prestige of a Goldman Sachs to make mm-hmm. it happen. And there are not that many Goldman Sachs around, so you got to pay the piper.
Yeah, but Sid, aren't they? Isn't Goldman putting their reputation, making big reputational risk there? I mean, maybe they didn't know that the thing was completely phony, but it's sort of a greedy fee.
It's a greedy fee that's gotten a lot of publicity because the deal has gone bad. But how many deals are there out there where nobody knows what those deals are, or only insiders know, and the fees are very, very high? I think the problem here was that the deal has some fatal flaws called corruption.
Yeah.
and that's going, and that now puts a lens on the whole thing, and then people see the $600 million, and that just compounds the whole thing.
All right, we've got one more segment left. We'll talk about the Sidcast when we get back. Our guest, Professor Sid Finkelstein, and he's unveiled recently the Sidcast. Tell us about it.
Oh, it's really a fun project. It's my podcast where I interview people that are very often beneath the radar. Really interesting, fascinating people that most listeners probably don't know about. I mean, there's some exceptions, but most won't know about. But that have a tremendous story. And in fact, everyone has a story. And the key is, How do you bring it out? You're a master interviewer yourself, Jim, so you understand what this is like. In my case, I'm talking about business and professional issues, but just as much I'm talking about personal life. And the question I'm really interested in, and I think a lot of people are, is how do we end up the way we end up? How do we craft a life? How do we end up doing what we're doing? How do we think about our work and our life and our families? And how did this all happen? In a sense, it's the most fundamental of all questions. Who are we? And I'm hoping that listeners that listen to me in conversation with these interesting people will gain some insights, not only about what they learn directly from the conversation, but about themselves and how they think about the world. And that's really what I'm hoping to be able to accomplish.
Hey, that's a fascinating idea, that angle. Tell me. Give us an example. What kind of a person do you say below the radar? Are you talking about potential senior management? Who are they?
It could be. So I'll tell you some of the people that we've already recorded episodes. Some of them have been released. So Jim Beattie. Now, New York Yankee fans will say, "What are you talking about? He is not beneath the radar."
And a Dartmouth guy.
Yeah, and a Dartmouth guy. Yes, and he pitched in the World Series and won a game for the Yankees. In the late 70s, and he's been a general manager in professional baseball and a scout, and just recently retired. Happens to be my neighbor who lives around the corner. Fantastic guy, and so we talked about his life in baseball. And I asked him, in fact, what was it like to pitch for the New York Yankees in the World Series? Walk us through how you felt that day. Hmm. And he describes how he felt and what it was like. And then we use that as a springboard to talk about lots of other things that happened to him. There's a woman named Marisa Smith, who is a playwright and a publisher. Not too many people know who she is, but she just has had a fantastic, fascinating story about her own life. And I bet a lot of people are going to be able to resonate with it. This is a woman that is an entrepreneur, has had to figure out what to do along the way, has gone through relationships, has a couple of kids, and has had to invent and reinvent herself along the way, and doing it in a creative field. So we have sports, we have creative fields, we have certainly more business related, a lot of entrepreneurial types of people that I find fascinating, lots of variety of people that. That we're going to bring into the Sidcast.
Give us the logistics. How do you find it? What's your frequency, et cetera?
Yeah, so it's a once-a-week show. We release Sunday night, so Monday you can listen. Of course, they all stay on the playlist on iTunes or anywhere else, so anyone can listen to as many as they want. Where do I find them? So that's, people ask me, where do you find these people? Well, some of it are people I happen to know and have known for years. Others are, a place like Dartmouth, has unbelievable, talk about talent, unbelievable talent. I went through lists of faculty members in different fields, in the sciences and in the arts, and looked for the ones that were true outliers, really fascinating people. So as one example, there's a woman named Patricia Hanaway, who now teaches part-time at Dartmouth and part-time at Stanford. She is she worked as an animator and as a computer graphics expert on Toy Story, on Mulan. She spent 6 months in New Zealand working with Peter Jackson on Lord of the Rings. She has one amazing story after another about her career, and she happens to be teaching at Dartmouth. So I find people that way as well. The problem is not finding the people. The problem is finding enough time to get to all these amazing people. So many people have a great story to tell.
Fun. How long is it?
We're going at about an hour, a little bit over an hour. That's been a challenge for me, frankly, because the conversations are so interesting. I think I can go a couple hours, and it's a bit tough to do. And I think your show is an hour, more or less. And I think there's something of a sweet spot there.
As we finish up, what is the state of business schools? Have they made the transition to where they need to be to keep relevant, the value added, things like that? And of course the issue of is there enough emphasis on the moral values you were talking about that should go part and parcel with obviously maximization of shareholder value?
I think business schools continually need to reinvent themselves. And that happens to a lesser or greater extent at different places. Certainly at Tuck, we've gone through a major curriculum analysis and review and making a bunch of changes, teaching things that maybe we hadn't taught as much before, machine learning, artificial intelligence, topics that are, blockchain and all these things that they were nobody's curriculum, 5 or 10 years ago. With respect to the moral side, there's a real desire among students, young people that decide to go for MBAs, to learn more about and experience more about leadership, which, of course, is good for me because that's my sweet spot, and I'm spending a lot of time redesigning a bunch of things at Tuck to emphasize leadership in a much more direct and practical manner. So I'm finding that young people really really have a desire to learn more about business and not just the traditional, let's learn about finance and accounting and economics. Yeah, they want to know about that, but those are not the real differentiators at the end of the day. You go to any one of 50 different business schools, and you're going to learn enough about accounting and economics and all the rest. Where are you going to learn the things that are really the big differentiators, which is how to be more creative, how to build relationships with people, how to be energetic and exciting and compelling enough so that people want to be on your team, in other words, to be a leader. These are the things that are the biggest differentiators. They're tougher to learn in a classroom, so you got to do more experiential things. But that's what students want, and I think that's the direction business schools are going, at least the best of them.
Yeah, we always talk about the importance of culture. Whole cultures are built around team play, so it's a unique thing that will survive forever as a great differentiator. The Sidcast. Sidcast.com, is that how we get it? S-Y-D?
Yes, S-Y-D, Sidcast.com, and of course on iTunes, Stitcher, and everyone else.
Thanks to Sid Finkelstein, Superbosses, How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to the professor. Thanks to our national audience for listening. And again, we'll see everybody next Sunday night on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.